guys, we're back here at VetFolio Voice with an episode about pancreatitis, sponsored by SIVA and featuring Dr. Harry Cridge. What a wonderful person to sit down with and be able to pick his brain. I mean, pancreatitis, what an elusive condition. From diagnosis to treatment to prognosis, pancreatitis can be so incredibly variable. And in case that didn't make it hard enough, somehow we have to communicate all of this variability to our clients while trying to treat these patients. Let me tell you, Dr. Cridge and I had about an hour set aside for this conversation, and I kept him there the whole time because I, hopefully not unlike you, have oh so many questions about managing pancreatitis. We talked about how to get an accurate diagnosis, current treatment recommendations, including Panaquil CA1, and how to set client expectations around prognosis and prevention in the case of chronic or recurrent pancreatitis. So with that in mind, let me go ahead and introduce Dr. Cridge and let's get into our talk. Dr. Cridge is an ACVIM and ECVIM board certified internal medicine specialist with clinical and research interests in disorders of the exocrine pancreas. He's an RCVS recognized specialist in small animal medicine and gastroenterology. He's also an associate professor in the Department of Small Animal Clinical Sciences at Michigan State University College of Veterinary Medicine. He really did a great job of breaking all of this down for us, so let's go ahead and jump in. I'm here with Dr. Harry Cridge, and we're going to talk about a topic that, honestly, I'm a little bit nervous to talk about. It's pancreatitis, and I mean, I always feel like pancreatitis, it has this really variable presentation, and it has, you know, a lot of like supportive care involved in the treatment plan. I always feel like I need to do more. So I'm a little nervous that I'm going to find out in this talk that I should have been doing more the whole time. So thank you for joining me to talk about, you know, a really complicated subject.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's my favorite topic to talk about. So I'm excited to be here.
I love it. I love it. Let's start with pathophysiology. Like I said, really variable presentation. I feel like I see dogs who maybe come in with just some mild GI upset and they do have an abnormal CPLI or something like that, all the way to like fatal necrotizing pancreatitis. So what's kind of the pathophysiology behind pancreatitis and why we get these really variable presentations?
Yeah, and I think that's honestly one of the things that makes pancreatitis so hard, right, is there's this varying degree of clinical severity from mild cases that can be treated outpatient to those that require, you know, even referrals. And not only that, but once the pancreas is annoyed, as you know, all the inflammation occurs and there's lots of other organ systems that get involved. So its complexity can escalate pretty rapidly. One of the things when we talk about the pathophysiology of pancreatitis, we sort of look back scarily to vet school and we talk about sort of the co-localization theory and all these other things. But over the past 10 to 15 years, there's been a huge expansion in our understanding of the mechanisms that cause pancreatitis, but ultimately they trigger one of two things, trypsinogen activation prematurely within the pancreas or a trypsinogen independent pathway. And both those pathways work together and they cause inflammation and necrosis. And the amount of inflammation and necrosis and the amount of neutrophils involved ultimately depends whether the animal's going to be subclinically affected but SNAP positive or if they're going to be, you know, moderately severe or even the more and more severe cases. So sort of how far along that spectrum they go is all dependent on how much inflammation is developed as a result of those individual mechanisms.
Okay, so the amount of inflammation, did I hear you right, saying kind of dependent on like the amount of neutrophils that are going to show up and create this inflammation, this
exactly.
Inflammatory response. And I completely remember what trypsinogen does in the pancreas, but just, you know, maybe for those who don't remember what it does, can you remind us about that pathway?
Yes, that's a really, really good question. So anytime we think of physiology, we have to sort of think about what the pancreas does. So the main role of the exocrine pancreas is to make digestive enzymes, and they're meant to be active where they're needed in the intestine. So trypsinogen is sort of the main inactive digestive enzyme made in that cell, and then it gets released and activated in the intestine. In pancreatitis, the contrast to that is, for some reason, there's various cellular events that go on, and instead of that enzyme becoming active in the intestine, it becomes active inside the pancreatic cell, and because it's a digestive enzyme, it digests what's around it, and this time it's the pancreas, and that's what causes the inflammation and all that swelling and all that local tissue damage as well.
And will the inflammation in the pancreas and the release of these digestive enzymes ultimately result in the release of more digestive enzymes into the pancreas and the intestine and worsen that inflammation?
Yes, the biggest thing is once we digest that pancreas, all those barriers between the cells, the pericellular barriers break down. So anything that's inside those acinar cells is going to start leaking out. And that's what causes that cranial abdominal discomfort and all that inflammation and swelling in those areas.
Gosh, whenever I think about the pathophysiology of like the pancreas essentially like digesting itself, it just sounds painful and scary. Yeah. And so then, you know, you get these presentations and it can be a little bit unnerving, especially like diagnostically speaking, because of course, you know, we want to make sure we're treating the right thing. And I mentioned, you know, mild abdominal discomfort and an abnormal CPLI, but I sometimes struggle with that CPLI test because I'm like, is it going to change my plan? Is it really going to be specific to what is going on and what I'm trying to treat? So what about diagnosing pancreatitis? I feel like that's a challenge.
Yeah, again, everything with the pancreas is unfortunately very challenging, but diagnosis is for sure one of those things. When we look at each individual thing we can look at, so history, unfortunately, a lot of these cases are relatively non-specific GI signs, so they're not going to give us a clue that this is pancreatitis. They may have some cranial abdominal pain, but not all dogs do, and that can also occur with a lot of other diseases. And then we sort of look at lipase, and then we look at imaging. And lipase is great because it's one of the most specific assays we have. So if that lipase is elevated, that pancreatic-specific lipase, we know it's coming from the pancreas. And the reason we use that as a biomarker is normally, in normal health, that gets, it doesn't leak out into the blood. It stays sort of in that region and it doesn't leak out. So when we have leakage and detection of that in the systemic circulation, it means something happened with that cell. It got damaged somehow, and that's what leaks out. The one thing it doesn't help tell us is, did that pancreas become annoyed because something else was annoyed? Or was the pancreas the starter of all this inflammation? And sometimes imaging and ruling out other differentials can really help with that. And that's where we sort of recommend potentially x-rays and ultrasound to try and work out what's going on. But we need to take all of those components together and make our overall best educated judgment on that. No single test is going to tell us, does this animal have pancreatitis? And one of the other challenges we see as clinicians is, you know, even when we convince an owner to spend, you know, several hundred dollars to do lipase, ultrasound, and all those things, if it's available to us, sometimes they don't all agree.
True. Or yeah, you'll have things that come back normal, but you're like, but it really looks like pancreatitis, and it can be challenging, which actually that brings up the question when we're talking about pancreatic lipase, the normal versus abnormal, because remind me again, because it's like one will definitively rule it out, and then the other one is like, doesn't definitively rule it in.
Yeah, so when we talk about pancreatic lipase tests, I think the way I at least like to think about it is the patient side SNAP test, the SNAP CPL, that is designed to be really sensitive, but only moderately specific.
Okay.
So if I have an abnormal result, that means it's going to be either a gray zone or an elevated result, but it's not going to say definitively pancreatitis. If that result comes back negative, that animal has low circulating levels of lipase at that time, so it doesn't have active disease at that time. So it's a really good test to rule out pancreatic inflammation, but it doesn't help necessarily to rule it in. We still have to look at a lot of the other things, including send-out lipases where we get a number, or ultrasound and various other things.
And with ultrasound, I'll be honest, I'm not amazing with an ultrasound by any means. In my experience, I feel like the pancreas can be a little bit challenging to image. So what are we looking for in ultrasound? How are we trying to get that image to help support our diagnosis?
Yeah, so I suppose it, you know, ultimately goes down to one of the questions we have to ask ourselves as clinicians is, you know, how definitive do we need to be before we start giving these supportive care? One of the things I want to make sure we've ruled out is something that would need different treatment. So like a foreign body, so x-rays can even do that. But if we want to be really sure of our diagnosis, we want that ultrasound. And we can link the ultrasound findings to what we see in physiology. So in physiology, we get inflammation, lots of things get broadened into the pancreas. So on imaging, what that looks like is the pancreas is bigger, and it's also hypoechoic or dark because it's bringing in a lot of this edema and swelling. And then all that tissue around it's going to get annoyed because remember, we break down those pericellular barriers and all that inflammation occurs. So in summary, we get a large pancreas that's dark or hypoechoic with a bright surrounding mesentery.
Okay. That's actually really helpful because I'm like, if I can find the pancreas, then yeah. I'm happy. And so that gives some really specific parameters to say, okay, well, if you found it and then if you have these parameters, it's supportive of that diagnosis. I think that was a really good way to put it. Like, how definitive do we have to be before we start implementing treatment? So I guess I'll ask you, how definitive do we have to be before we start implementing treatment?
Yeah, so certainly on my level, my clinical question becomes, you know, is this a case where I'm trying to be 1,000% sure because, you know, we're going to do a study or something else where we have to be really sure of our cases? Those cases, I'm going to make sure we have everything checked. If I'm having a patient that's a little bit more limited in finance, or, you know, we've only got so much and we want to put it towards treatment, my biggest thing is let's rule out things that need to be treated differently. And that is going to be the GI foreign bodies, because a lot of those can present with, you know, vomiting, cranial abdominal pain. They might even have an abnormal SNAP test because the pancreas is secondarily annoyed. So making sure we at least get those x-rays to say, okay, this is not a foreign body. I can go ahead and give supportive care and potentially some other treatments that we'll talk about a little bit later on as well.
That does make a lot of sense, because initially when you said x-rays, I was like, huh, what am I looking for in x-rays? But yes, a friend and colleague of mine who did a lot of ER work, she said, you know, she has cut a lot of foreign bodies that were diagnosed as pancreatitis, and then you go and you find the foreign body afterwards. So that makes sense with the x-rays to make sure and rule that out. So we're talking about supportive care, and that's always been my approach to pancreatitis is, you know, will we treat supportively until the pancreas calms down and is happy again? Is that still the general treatment recommendation for pancreatitis, or are there specific treatment options that we need to be thinking of?
Yeah, so the one of the really exciting things is there's some new novel treatments on sort of available to us now as clinicians, but they're still going to be used with supportive and symptomatic care. The challenge with the supportive and symptomatic care you've seen is, you know, we sort of give everything we can for many, many years into these cases, and they sort of got better or they didn't.
Right.
And the you know, the mortality rates and other things can be fairly high in some of these really severe cases. So there's been a lot of research over 10 to 15 years trying to work out, is there something we can do other than just supportive care? And then SIVA's made a new novel product that's licensed in the U.S. now, conditionally approved by the FDA. And what that drug does, it's Hanaquil CA1 or fusiplatib, and it's designed to reduce the neutrophil migration from the blood vessel into the tissues. And the theory there is if less neutrophils get from the blood vessel into the tissues, we're going to get less pancreatic inflammation and less systemic inflammation. And what they've shown in some of the data that's out there right now is it has improved the clinical signs associated with acute onset of pancreatitis. And it's an injectable medication given once daily for 3 days.
I was actually thinking about Panaquil CA1, and I went, you know, is it injectable? Is it not? And I went, well, it's pancreatitis. It has to be injectable, because how else will you get it into them?
Exactly.
So I love the idea of having this drug specifically to treat pancreatitis, but like we've been talking about up to this point, getting that actual diagnosis can be challenging. So how do we know when to reach for Panaquil CA1?
Yeah, so for me, again, the question becomes is, this drug is designed to reduce neutrophil migration into the pancreas. So I want to make sure that, you know, we're giving that drug early enough that it's going to reduce some of that inflammation in that pancreas and help prevent some of these potential systemic consequences. So for me, again, it goes back to, on a clinical basis, what do I need to know before I start treating supportively and with other drugs like Panaquil? So if I've ruled out a foreign body and I have a clinical suspicion that this is pancreatitis, that mimics the exact same situation that they used in the clinical trials. They had GI signs and a SNAP test, and that's sort of what they used to try and mimic what, you know, veterinarians are really doing in practice. So it's certainly safe to use in those situations. My big thing, again, is going to be ruling out things that need to be treated differently.
That makes sense. And it kind of gives you that sense of security if you feel comfortable that you've ruled out a foreign body and you have a clinical suspicion to feel safe to go ahead and reach for this drug. Are there contraindications or safety concerns we should be aware of?
Yeah, so as with any new medication, you know, we always sort of take a little bit of time to work out and fully understand the adverse effects. So what we have right now is there's a freedom of information summary. So SIVA went through the steps of having this drug conditionally approved by the FDA, and they're going through ongoing trials to get full approval. But as part of that, they publish a lot of data that anybody can look at. So you in practice can look at it too. And the sort of things that I look at to see, you know, what could we potentially expect to see with this drug is anything that was reported in the clinical trial. So in that data, they report any adverse event in the drug, the animals that got Panaquil and those that did not. So we then sort of have to look and see how frequently did it occur in one group, how frequently did it occur in the other, to see could this be from Panaquil or could this be from underlying disease. So a lot of the dogs in the study had GI signs, slightly higher frequency in the Panaquil group, but again, it's an animal with pancreatitis, they're probably going to have GI signs. There were various other adverse effects reported, but nothing that was, you know, directly presumed to be related to the Panaquil or of major clinical significance. So GI side effects, there were some animals that had respiratory compromise, you know, whether that was aspiration pneumonia or okay. something else going on. Yeah, and there was various other adverse events reported. And then the other sort of data you can look at, and I'd encourage everybody to look at this when they use the drug, is they also published data on something called the target animal species safety data. So that's where the drug company gives the medication that they intend to use to animals of the species they're doing, so dogs, and they give it at higher doses and for longer periods of time, and they look at adverse events there. And I think there was an animal that had a little bit of inflammation at the catheter site, but it had a catheter issue. There's some animals that got hypertension and various other things. So all that data is publicly available. But at least from what I've done so far, there's been nothing that's, you know, been overtly concerning to me just yet.
Sure. All that, you know, it leaves that question mark of, like, was it really related to the Panaquil, or was it just related to the underlying disease? And we've been talking a lot about conditionally approved drugs lately, yeah. which is exciting because we're getting all these new animal-specific drugs that are specifically for these disease processes. But just for anybody listening who may not be familiar with the conditional approval, can you remind us what conditional approval means?
As you mentioned, there's a lot of new drugs on the market, and they all have this sort of CA at the end. So Panaquil is CA1, so it's the conditional approval the first year. And what that means is that the company has gone through the steps of submitting data to the FDA, and that the FDA is satisfied that it's a safe medication and that has a reasonable expectation for efficacy. So they looked at the data that's presented and they say, yes, this data supports what the drug company is suggesting. And what that does, it then allows the medication to be marketed and sold and get to the animals that need this medication earlier on while they're doing these pivotal efficacy studies. And then ultimately, to get full approval, the company has to show substantial evidence of efficacy. So that's what's sort of ongoing now, is getting a lot more data on this drug to make sure that we can, you know, see, does it meet the standards for full FDA approval? And that's what the drug company is working on right now.
And I would imagine it wouldn't be a problem with Panaquil, because you're going to use it in a very specific way, but making sure that we're using it very much on label until it goes beyond the conditional approval.
Exactly.
Do we have data on, like, what the efficacy has been to this point? Like, what kind of results are we seeing in animals that are treated with Panaquil CA1 in terms of their disease course?
Yeah, so the in terms of the data that we have available right now, it's any of the data that was sort of in that conditional FDA approval, and it was recently published by Jörg Steiner out of Texas A&M in the Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine. But what that data shows is, they look at something called the Modified Canine Activity Index, which is basically a fancy way of saying the clinical signs of pancreatitis. So they look at various parameters, and they looked at them over time, and they looked at them in animals that got Panaquil and those that did not. And the people that gave the drug didn't know if they were given a control or the Panaquil. And they looked at how fast these clinical signs improved, or this clinical activity index. And the clinical activity index improved statistically significantly greater in the Panaquil group versus the other group. So that's why the drug is labeled for improvement of the clinical signs associated with acute onset of pancreatitis.
That's really exciting, yeah. because those clinical signs can get serious very quickly. And I feel like it's reassuring to know that if we have a strong clinical suspicion, we can feel comfortable reaching for Panaquil CA1. Can you remind us what other sort of symptomatic care we should really make sure that we're implementing in these patients to give them the best chance at recovery?
Yeah, and that's a really great point. So the way that Panaquil has been studied and intended to be used is in conjunction with that supportive and symptomatic care that we've done for, you know, many, many years. In terms of what I think of in terms of supportive and symptomatic care, I think of fluid therapy. So we need to make sure we're really accurately assessing these animals for dehydration, getting them rehydrated, because the pancreas is really, really sensitive to changes in blood flow. Other things we need to think about is pain relief medications. And in terms of pain relief, the area we're sort of backed into right now with pain relief is opioids. Because other pain relief medications like NSAIDs, we can't really use in pancreatitis because they have negative effects on the GI tract, and these animals may also already have kidney injury and other things that could be worsened by an NSAID. So really focusing on opioids for our pain relief where we can, and then nutrition, and making sure that we're feeding these patients early. In the past, we used to say, hold off on the food for now. But there's a lot of data now that shows that if we get early enteral nutrition on board, these animals are going to do better. The big thing there is a lot of people get really nervous and like, oh, I've got to make sure this animal eats 100% of its resting energy requirement. What we know is that as long as we're getting some nutrition across those enterocytes, those intestinal cells, they're going to be a lot happier and those patients are going to do better. So getting some level of nutrition in, whether that's voluntary food intake if the animal will, or occasionally placing a nasogastric or nasoesophageal tube just to make sure that we're providing nutrition to those patients.
Okay, and I have like some specifics here just for my own knowledge, because sometimes I run into these questions. I love that you said nasogastric or nasoesophageal, because I was going to say, you know, are we primarily focused on appetite stimulants versus, you know, assisted feeding like an esophageal tube or something like that? And it sounds like that's kind of patient dependent. As far as pain relief goes, do you have an opioid preference? Like, my feeling has tended to be like towards buprenorphine for the GI motility effects, but do you feel like they need, you know, something stronger, like a full mu, or again, very patient dependent?
Yeah, so some of those sort of mild to moderate cases, they may get away with a partial mu like buprenorphine. And we always talk, anytime we talk opioids, is what is the effect on the GI tract?
Right.
And there's a lot of, you know, discussion about that, but when we really go back to how much data we have on actual motility, it's actually like kind of surprisingly sparse.
Okay.
So I think it's really, really important to think about, but we don't really have a lot of data in dogs, at least clinically affected dogs, which of the following medications is going to have the worst effect on GI motility. I try to stick to full mu where I can for the more severe cases, those hospitalized cases, because it's going to have better pain relief.
Sure.
And in those, everybody sort of argues which sort of full mu to use. There's sort of two camps that are out there right now in terms of which one to use. Some people use things like methadone.
Right.
And that is, you know, certainly what a lot of people use. Myself and a few of my other colleagues have a preference towards fentanyl in these animals. That's just because it's a really good pain relief medication, but also because it has a shorter half-life. So this is why my preference is fentanyl, is when we think of ileus, which is such a big problem in these severe pancreatitis cases, one of the sort of many differentials, but two of the big ones is going to be too much opioid. You know, I slowed that GI motility down too much. But another one that we don't always think about as much is pain. So if an animal has abdominal pain, they may also develop ileus as well.
Sure.
So in a clinical situation, we don't necessarily know, is this, you know, too little pain relief and pain, or is this too much opioid and GI ileus? So in those situations, I prefer to have something with a shorter half-life where it can titrate up and titrate down and see which one's going to help the patient the best. Because, you know, if I make a decision and I get it wrong with methadone, it may be waiting 4 to 6 hours till I can change it again. Whereas fentanyl, it may be just a few minutes.
Sure, that makes sense. That, yeah, you're kind of trying to negate that ileus one way or another. Like, not too much opioid, but if you leave them in pain, they're still going to get ileus.
Exactly.
So you have to get that treated. So it just goes on to how complicated it is to treat this disease. What about prokinetics? Is there a role for prokinetics, like metoclopramide or something like that?
Yeah, so metoclopramide is certainly often discussed and utilized in these cases for ileus. My sort of approach to ileus in these cases is sort of starting with adjusting the pain relief, seeing if we titrate up or down, and then making sure that we're adequately hydrated but not overhydrated, because there's some suspicion, at least right now, that overhydration and may cause gut edema.
No kidding.
And cause, you know, potential ileus. So there's a lot of factors at play. And one of the things we always do is we say, you know, this animal has too much opioid, drop the opioid, or we say add in metoclopramide. And hopefully over the next few years, we're going to get a little bit more data on, you know, which of these actually occurs most frequently. So my preference is hydration, make sure we're adequately hydrated, move on to looking at our opioids and making sure we're adequately give sufficient pain relief, but also not too much pain relief. And then finally, I'll think about things like metoclopramide. There is one, at least theoretical, disadvantage of metoclopramide. So the way metoclopramide works is it's a dopamine receptor antagonist. And normally we don't really need to know how these drugs work at the patient side. But there's one potential, at least theoretical, disadvantage in that dopamine is one of the things that helps blood flow to the pancreas.
Right.
So if we drop the dopamine, the theory, and again, not a lot of clinical data, would be we could affect pancreatic perfusion. And if we did that, the pancreas may get more annoyed. So I tend to, just because of that theory, sort of leave metoclopramide to my last sort of resort and then use it in those cases. And I've found a lot of these cases, if we play with the pain relief first, a lot of them can control the ileus.
I would agree. I feel like that's overall been my experience too. It just sometimes it feels like I should be doing more. Like I'm just, you know, giving you fluids and nutrition and pain relief and you're so sick and there's more that I should be doing that sometimes I have to sit on my hands to not have to reach for other drugs and treatments.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things with pancreatitis. It's so complex. There's so many things we want to do. We know that these animals, you know, want support. But one of the things, and this took me, you know, a little bit of time to work out post-residency, is sometimes these animals, the one of the best treatments we can have is more time on the things that we're already doing. But, you know, sometimes we can be a little impatient too.
I'm not known for my patience.
Same here.
What about causes of pancreatitis? That's always, you know, the question we get from clients is how did they get this? And sometimes it's garbage gut. You know, yep. You can identify it very easily. But sometimes it seems to come out of nowhere. Or, you know, we'll get these, you know, these certain patients that it seems like it's either chronic or recurrent. So what should we be aware of and how do we communicate causes of pancreatitis to clients?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the big questions out there. So when we sort of look at what's gone on in human medicine versus veterinary medicine, you know, several decades ago in human medicine, they called a lot of their cases idiopathic, in that there was no underlying cause, but they've done a lot of research. And over time, you know, the amount of cases in human medicine that are now deemed idiopathic is actually very, very small. When we look at veterinary medicine, idiopathic is still sort of our big, broad category in that we don't know why a lot of these animals get pancreatitis. But there's the more and more research that has been done, we've certainly found some things that predispose. One of the biggest ones and the ones that I encourage people to look for is lipid disorders, so things like hypertriglyceridemia. We know that high circulating triglycerides are associated with higher pancreatic lipase concentrations and higher risks of pancreatitis. So the challenge with triglycerides is they're not always on our routine chemistry. So we sort of have to think, you know, let's potentially add this on. And then if the triglycerides are very high, so I think sort of the 600 to 800 or above mark, that may have been the reason that animal developed pancreatitis. And if that's the case, that animal may need specific treatment for high triglycerides. A lot of that treatment is things we do with pancreatitis anyway, like low-fat diets. But if that doesn't work, we may need to add on other medications to bring those triglyceride levels down and help prevent future occurrences. So I really encourage even first-time offenders to try and get those triglycerides. You can call the lab and just add it on. It's a serum sample, so relatively easy to do, just to make sure that we document whether that is a risk factor or not.
Now I have questions about triglycerides because those get complicated, I feel like, too. Because, you know, sometimes I'll get a triglyceride back and I'm like, it was probably just a non-fasted sample. Would it be reasonable to say, you know, if we had that 600 to 800 range in a non-fasted patient, that could be normal for them, or should it never be that high?
Yeah, so at least in my experience, you know, a mild elevation in triglycerides certainly can happen in a non-fasted patient. I have not, at least yet, seen an animal that's had circulating triglycerides of that 600 to 800 or above just from not fasting.
Okay.
So even if we get those back and fast them, the results haven't actually been a lot different right now. So I would say if they're really markedly elevated, there's probably something else going on other than just not fasting.
And what sort of disorders would cause that hyperlipidemia, and what sort of medications would we be reaching for to help address those triglycerides?
Yeah, so there's some breeds of dogs that get a lot of pancreatitis but also get a lot of triglyceride disorders, and they're sort of just thought to be, you know, a breed-related disorder. And the main poster child for that is the miniature schnauzer.
Sure.
So we see a lot of those with pancreatitis, but a lot of those are really hypertriglyceridemic as well.
I feel like Yorkies, too.
Yorkies, yeah. I've seen a lot of Yorkies with hypertriglyceridemia. That's a really good example as well.
And we're thinking this is just a breed-related hypertriglyceridemia.
Yeah, and then there are other types, too. So if we have lipid disorders, we can also get them from endocrinopathy. So Cushing's disease, diabetes mellitus, hypothyroidism, they may also be associated with various different lipid disorders as well. So potentially screening for those if the animal has relevant clinical signs.
And I'm guessing if we have like a hypothyroid or a Cushing's or something like that, we are going to reach for, you know, we're going to treat the underlying cause to bring those down. What if we have just a breed-related hypertriglyceridemia?
Yeah, so sort of the breed-related ones, the first step is going to be that low-fat diet.
Okay.
But in that patient, I'm going to be more strict with a low-fat diet because we know that it may need it for its pancreatitis, but it certainly also needs it for its triglycerides. So that's the one where we're going to try and be a little bit firmer and making sure we get that diet. And
no garbage gut for you, my friend.
Exactly. And then there's been various other things that have been proposed. So omega-3s can help those patients too. And then fibrate medication. So there's lots of different fibrates out there. The one that I like to use the most, or has had most recent data on, is a drug called fenofibrate. And it's, you know, on all the sort of medication apps that you can use to find doses and things like that. But it's a medication. It's a human medication. So you can get it from, like, CVS, Walgreens, all the different pharmacies. And it's a medication that works really, really well at getting these triglycerides down.
No kidding. It is not something I have been familiar with at all. And, you know, maybe I'm, you know, revealing a little too much there to, hopefully there's not a ton of people out there who are like, what are you talking about?
But yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things, right, is, you know, we've got to find these hypertriglyceridemic patients first to be, like, really comfortable with treating them. And that's why it's so important to add on that triglycerides. But that medication, you know, the majority of those dogs are going to respond to the diet. But then if they're still not responding, they're the ones we have to add in these other drugs.
Sure.
And they may be cases where you want to chat with your local internist or other things before using them. But they're certainly very effective and very safe drugs.
I feel like I'm going down the rabbit hole here because now I have so many questions about triglycerides. But what if they're non-clinical for the hyperlipidemia and that, you know, they're not having any signs of pancreatitis or GI upset?
Yeah, so in those cases, even when they're not showing active signs right now, if those triglycerides sort of in those, you know, 800-ish range, those animals are at risk of developing pancreatitis. So I'm still going to try and control those triglycerides now in the hope that treating this is going to prevent a future episode of pancreatitis, and putting the money in now may help to save a lot more money in the future.
Okay. That makes sense. I will take a closer look at those triglycerides. Yeah. I do feel like they come back on a lot of my chemistries, and, you know, I have been known to recheck them when they're really high and say, bring them back with a fasted sample and let's see. But I don't think in my non-clinical patients I've gotten really aggressive with worrying about it, so I will pay much closer attention to that going forward. What about chronic versus recurrent pancreatitis?
Yeah, so right now we sort of don't have a lot of data on is this, you know, chronic disease, or is this acute on chronic, or is this recurrent flares? To me, the question still becomes, until we get more data on how to manage these, you know, truly histopathologically chronic cases, is I have an animal that keeps getting pancreatitis, whether this is, you know, acute disease and it's going away and then completely coming back anew, or if it's an acute on chronic or a chronic that's clinically severe. All of those cases ultimately are patients that are having pancreatitis that are at your hospital. So in those cases, we still treat them the same in terms of supportive care, adding in novel therapies such as Panaquil CA1. But the next question becomes is there a way that I can help prevent this patient coming back through the hospital or through the ER, or, you know, wherever it's going to present? And those are the ones where I try and go back to the causes, and I try and screen more aggressively for underlying causes. So that may be the one where we ask a little bit more detailed food history. That may be the one where we say, okay, you know, we didn't do the triglycerides last time because we tried to save a little bit of money. Let's do the triglycerides now. Let's also look for other risk factors. Could this animal be Cushingoid, hypothyroid, or diabetic? You know, hypothyroid, we have to wait till they're clinically well to test. Same with Cushing's. Looking for these underlying causes where we can. There are very, very rare cases of drug-associated pancreatitis, which I don't think we really talk about because they're so rare. But I've certainly seen a case or two that have been referred to us for that. There are certain drugs that are out there. There's a lot of them that have been reported in human medicine and various individual case reports. So certainly not something that you'd be expected to have come across in practice or even, you know, in specialty medicine. But there are drugs, and the ones that I feel have the most evidence behind potential associations with pancreatitis is phenobarbital, potassium bromide, so a lot of our seizure medications, and then L-asparaginase, which is a chemo drug.
Okay.
So the times where I see those cases, it's normally an animal with idiopathic seizures and they're on phenobarb or phenobarb and potassium bromide.
Sure.
And those animals may be developing pancreatitis secondary to those drugs. And in those cases, we have to think, okay, which disease are we prioritizing? Can we switch these anti-seizure drugs to a different medication? I haven't yet seen any cases related to Keppra, so Keppra may be a suitable alternative for those cases. But those drugs can also be, going back to lipids, can cause high lipid levels. So again, controlling the lipids may be an alternate approach to those tricky cases as well.
Okay, that makes sense. You know, they're being metabolized through the liver and so potentially causing this hyperlipidemia, but maybe we can keep them on those drugs and give them something additional to bring those triglycerides down.
Like a low-fat diet, or if that's still not working, thinking about some of those other treatments, or saying, okay, is this a patient that would be safe to potentially transition to another anti-seizure drug? And that's going to be really case dependent.
I feel like I'm learning so much here. This is very exciting.
Awesome. And this just to help people sort of find where those lists of drugs are, we published a review article, open access, in the Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine. I think it's called New Insights into the Etiology and Pathogenesis of Pancreatitis. And there's a table in there that sort of has all the potential risk factors for pancreatitis in. So I use that as a bit of a checklist in these recurrent cases, as have I looked for this? Have I looked for this?
That's a fantastic resource because it is so multifaceted to be able to kind of have that checklist, that algorithm, so to speak. And if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like it doesn't necessarily matter if it's acute on chronic or, you know, recurrent or whatever it is that we're looking at. We're still going to screen for the risk factors in the same way and check off our checklist and see if we can find the underlying cause and treat it.
That's absolutely sort of where we're at right now. In the future, if we, you know, get more data on these chronic cases, perhaps we may treat those a little differently. But for right now, I still treat those as a case of pancreatitis, and I try my best to find a reason why they have it and why it keeps coming back. And if we can find something and treat it and reduce the frequency of disease in the future, that's absolutely going to be best for the patient, be best for you, and it's going to be best for the owner as well.
Sure. What about one of those, you know, kind of strange GI presentations, like a lymphangiectasia or something? Would that be a risk factor?
Yeah, so there have been some studies that have looked at sort of these chronic neuropathies and elevated pancreatic lipases. I've certainly seen a few cases where they have, you know, primary GI disease and then also secondary pancreatic involvement. So, yeah, if there's certainly signs of other disorders, treating the underlying disease may be beneficial as well.
Sure. So it could be associated with like a chronic enteropathy or something as well. Mm-hmm. Prognosis. We mentioned in the beginning, you know, sometimes it's a mild GI upset and they resolve with, you know, 24 hours of supportive care. And then other times, you know, we can get necrosis and even up to being fatal. What is the overall prognosis for patients with pancreatitis? And does it matter if it's acute or chronic?
Yeah, so this is, again, another really big question we have. And in veterinary medicine, when we sort of look at what data's out there, one of the things we have to think about is that data that's out there shows like fairly high mortality rates. But they're typically from, you know, tertiary referral academic centers, or even from several, you know, decades ago. So we don't have a really good data set that looks at, you know, the true presentation. A lot of these cases are being treated really, really well in general practice, and they never come to academia.
Sure.
And they probably have a much, you know, better prognosis than what we potentially see. So the prognosis question is probably going to be very frustrating, but we don't really have a good idea. But, you know, going back to sort of broad generalizations, there can be patients that do absolutely fantastic, you know, need brief supportive care and do really well. But they can change, and when they can change fairly rapidly. So making sure that there are options for more advanced care where we need them is going to be important. And an animal, you know, still, even despite new treatments and all this other supportive care and, you know, the best support we can give them, some of them can still pass away from these diseases as well.
Sure. So it's kind of the universal answer to medicine.
Yes,
it depends.
It really depends. Yeah.
But I think that's good to be aware of, because then it facilitates that client communication of, look, you know, we feel pretty good about our plan here, but this could change rapidly. So be aware of that. Here's what to look for, and here's when we need to refer and get a little bit more intense with our supportive care.
Yeah, and that's a really great point, is these client conversations is, you know, if this patient presents to us sort of mild and we're like, okay, let's treat it supportively, let's do the things that we usually do, and we send them out the door, we need to make sure that that owner knows that, you know, things can change. And at least in my opinion, it can change a little bit faster than some of those other disorders we sort of treat on an outpatient basis. So having that conversation first really helps, that if that was that patient that comes back more severe, they've sort of had the heads up.
Right, and they're prepared and they know when to call. So they're not going, well, you said it was going to get better. Yeah. So I figured I would just wait it out. And you're like, oh, no.
Exactly.
So along those lines of client communication, we've talked about how it can kind of make our heads spin as veterinarians between the variability in presentation, the supportive care, having to kind of sit on your hands and wait it out, which can be challenging, and how rapidly these cases can change. That can be, it's a lot for us to take in. It can be a lot for a client to take in that conversation. Do you have any tips for communicating with clients about pancreatitis, kind of what to expect and what to look for and how to be prepared for that?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, a lot of what we touched on is sort of having those conversations with the owner early on. So, you know, like, we, at the moment, your dog is presented fairly mild and we're confident that our treatment plan is going to help support your dog. But potentially, you know, things can escalate and can escalate a little bit rapidly. So we want you to be part of the team in monitoring for these adverse effects and sort of letting us know when they occur, because we may need to bring that animal into the hospital. We may need to send them somewhere where they can be watched a little bit more closely, and having that conversation up front. And that's a conversation I think most vets are really, really good at having. The one thing that, you know, I think is sort of on the back end when that animal recovers is, hey, as a heads up, you know, some animals can get recurrent episodes of this disease. Right now, we don't have a known cause for what's going on in your dog, but we're going to still be careful with table scraps and various other things. But if these animals keep presenting and you keep coming back to us over the next few years, we may want to do some additional screening to try and work out, is there something going on that means that your dog's affected more commonly than another dog? Because then, at least if we've had that conversation again, when we say we want to do these extra blood work tests, we want to do these other things, the owner knows that sort of we're on the same team and trying to help get that animal better and prevent them having to come back and keep spending so much money in hospitalization.
I think that's such good advice of kind of planting that seed early, of especially I think of something like Cushing's disease, yeah. If that's the underlying cause, and that can be kind of a bear to diagnose. So kind of planting that seed early on of like, look, if this keeps happening, we really need to go down this road of finding the underlying cause if we can. And so that way, if we do have one of these patients that we're having to treat continuously and it is, you know, adding up financially, that's something that we've had that conversation ahead of time and the owner has had a chance to wrap their head around it and decide kind of where they want to go with things. And it's a less difficult conversation when you're treating pancreatitis for the second time or the third time, which is expensive and intense as it is. And now we're talking about adding on these additional tests. You know, they kind of have that idea early on. So that's such good advice to say, you know, just plant that seed from the beginning.
And it's also, you know, we're all very busy veterinarians, right? You know, when that patient comes in and we expect a fairly routine appointment and it turns out to be something else going on, if we've got sort of documented in the last visit, hey, this was thought to be a one-off, but these are the things we may check in the future, so like sort of a good heads up for us, as well as, you know, like we're really busy, we get caught in the moment, but hey, this has happened before, maybe I need to add on this extra blood work now.
That is so true. Yeah, I have been known to write notes to my future self of like, this is what you were gonna do if your plan didn't work.
Exactly. And
this is the perfect scenario for that.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Cridge, I have learned a lot from this talk. I know it's definitely going to affect the way that I interpret blood work and communicate with my clients and treat pancreatitis in the future. So I hope it's really beneficial to everybody out there listening. And I so appreciate you coming on and going through all of this with this really complicated disease. Any other thoughts you want to share with us before we wrap up?
I mean, that's the biggest thing is, you know, we need to sort of give ourselves some grace. These are really, really complex cases. But, you know, people are always there to reach out to if we need any additional help. And I'm so excited to have been able to chat with you and be able to reach the audiences that we can with this podcast. So thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. I can't wait to go find that paper in the Journal of Internal Med and use my checklist the next time I get a pancreatitis case.
Awesome.
All right. A big thank you to Siva for making this episode possible. Dr. Cridge, thank you so much for joining me and for all of the great information. And of course, thank you to all of you listeners out there for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts. It'll help other veterinary professionals like you find this and other great content that we try to put out there. For more episodes like this, click on the Education tab on the Vetfolio website. As always, we'd love to hear your input on this talk, as well as ideas for topics you'd like to hear from us in the future. Feel free to reach out to me at dvm@vetfolio.com. You can also visit my Facebook page at Dr. Cassie DVM, and you can find me on LinkedIn. And remember, if one animal is better off because of you today, it's a great day.